Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We bring you now direct from the Chicago Stadium in Chicago a broadcast of a nonpartisan citizens' mass meeting on the Supreme Court, sponsored by the Chicago Committee for the President's Court Plan. And tonight's speakers will be the Honorable Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior, and Alvin W. Barkley, United States Senator from Kentucky, who will speak concerning the plan for reorganization of the higher judiciaries.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Secretary of the Interior, the Honorable Harold L. Ickes.
Senator Barkley, ladies and gentlemen, when last I spoke in Chicago, the air was heavy with the thunderings of the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago News. Colonel McCormick was counting frantically the days that were left in which to save America. Colonel Knox had just made Virginia, North Carolina, Texas, and the border states safe for the Liberty League and was winding up his affairs preparatory to moving to Washington. On election night, a feast was spread in the Tribune Tower. It is not recorded whether the morning colonel invited his vesperal brother to share that feast. But it is recorded that what began as a victory dinner ended as a wake. Today, Chicago is the Chicago of last November. The same brazen throat croaked the same old hymn of hate with a man they couldn't stop then and can't stop now. I appreciate the applause that every speaker does, but we're behind time. For once more, that man has proved the courage for which they hate him. He has dared to cut the Gordian knot with which they thought they had tied up the election in the courts. They didn't believe anyone would have the sheer political courage to cut that knot. Make no mistake. This struggle to make the federal courts a living part of our generation is not a new war. It is only a second battle in the same war we were fighting last November. Those who are with Franklin D. Roosevelt today are trying to carry through the election of last November. Those who are against him today are trying to maintain in power a majority of Supreme Court justices who will nullify the election of November. But from the battle of last November, the enemy has learned a lesson. Even John Hamilton now knows that a front line of Hoovers, Smiths, and DuPonts, of Liberty Leagues and American Bar Associations, will make the American people reach for bigger bricks. So this time, Mr. Hamilton's front line consists of deserter decoys from the Roosevelt ranks of November, reactionary geographical Democrats, frightened by November's proof of a real democracy of America, peaked professional liberals who would rather have no reform than one for which someone else might get credit. But behind that thin front line of decoy Democrats and decoy liberals are the tanks, the artillery, and the poison gas of last November, the newspapers, the money, the organized propaganda, the McCormicks, the Knoxes, the Gannets, and of course the DuPonts. If you want to know why every man and woman of goodwill, why everyone who hopes that democracy may succeed in America, should be with President Roosevelt in this fight, take a look at the people who are against him. That one look will teach you more about the real issue involved than 1,000 of the ablest lawyers arguing for 1,000 years. The American people may not have the time or the interest to know the niceties of Marbury versus Madison or of writs of certiorari. but they need no lawyers in order to know their enemies when they see them. The president's proposal to rejuvenate the federal courts is now 2 months old. Never have we had such a fury of debate, never such pontificating of lawyers. 1 month ago, the president explained over the radio in a fireside talk why it was his considered judgment that the federal judiciary must be rejuvenated now if the mandate of the election was to be carried out, if democracy was to have a chance to succeed in this country. Today, when everything has been said that can be said, when the proceedings before the Senate committee have become a repetitious filibuster, let us see what the last 30 days have brought forth to answer or to confirm the simple common sense, the calm statesmanship of this fireside talk. In his fireside talk, the president charged that the majority of the Supreme Court had denied both to the Congress and the state legislatures the essential powers of free government, that something had to be done to end judicial tyranny. That charge has been admitted. Not one witness of consequence before the Senate Judiciary Committee, not one responsible leader of the opposition in or out of Congress, has denied the truth of that major indictment. None has been so high or so low as to do honor to the record of the Supreme Court over the last 25 years. None has denied that something must be done to cure that record. The only question has been how. In his fireside talk, the president agreed with Chief Justice Hughes that the Constitution was what the judges say it is, that the process of making a court decision is not, as Mr. Justice Roberts so piously and solemnly has insisted, merely, I quote, to lay the article of the Constitution which is invoked beside the statute which is challenged, and to decide whether the latter squares with the former, end quote. The president charged that the process of judicial interpretation made and unmade, amended and reamended the very Constitution itself. And oh, how that charge has been corroborated. Only a few days ago, in a burst of shotgun liberalism, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision in the Washington state minimum wage case, amended the Constitution to give working women the benefit of minimum wage protection, of which two other 5-4 decisions, one 14 years old, one only 10 months old, now turn out to have robbed them. This amendment by judicial decision was just as real as if it had been formally adopted by Congress and 36 state legislatures. As the Attorney General commented, the Constitution on Monday, March 29, 1937, does not mean the same thing that it meant on Monday, June 1, 1936. What has always been clear to those who have lived in national affairs is now clear to every American citizen, that the Constitution is not even what the justices say it is. It is, as it always has been, what the odd man among the justices say that it is. The president said that our trouble was not with the Constitution, but with the kind of judges who are interpreting it, that the present crisis was not judicial, but a constitutional crisis, that what we really needed was not a new constitution, but a way to save the present constitution from the judges for the people. In the minority opinion in the Washington minimum wage case, 4 judges, Mr. Justice Sutherland, Mr. Justice Vandeventer, Mr. Justice Butler and Mr. Justice McReynolds, all of them 70 years old or over, to whom the American people are committed to pay $20,000 a year for life, stated bluntly and finally that they are willing to learn nothing and to forget nothing, that changing economic conditions mean nothing to their well-insulated legal minds, that they do not take into consideration the fact that other men have different opinions in appraising the infallibility of their own. That self-restraint is a matter of will, and that there is no obligation upon any justice of the Supreme Court to exercise any self-restraint in passing upon a question submitted to the court. In other words, four judges of the average age of approximately 75 years have served notice on the nation that they are on a sit-down strike and will not help the people of the United States work out their modern problems. Read that opinion for yourselves and see the judicial open-mindedness, the judicial spirit of helpfulness for which the American people are paying four men $80,000 a year. That opinion tells the American people as clearly as legal language can speak that unless the present personnel of the court is enlarged, every new and debatable constitutional issue will come before the court with four justices definitely hostile to any theory which would permit the Constitution to be adapted to the needs of the times. Four out of nine votes are loaded, packed against the people. If there should be any difference among any one of the five justices whose minds are all open regarding the applicability of the Constitution to new problems, then the efforts of the legislatures, state or federal, to meet those problems would be nullified. Whether democracy can be made to work depends upon a single peripatetic vote. And what that arrogantly non-cooperative minority thinks of a country that doesn't like to pay $20,000 a year to a sit-down judge, we may learn from that enlightened homily on sportsmanship of Mr. Justice McReynolds only 3 weeks ago. The welfare of 120 million people, it seems, is the moral equivalent of a fox hunt. First and foremost, a Supreme Court constitutional case is a sporting proposition. And what is really important for the continuation of American traditions is not what happens to the daily lives of the people affected by a decision, but the sporting way in which they accept their fate from the gods of the Supreme Court. If the hundreds of thousands of children who have suffered in mine and mill and factory for years since the child labor decisions in which Justice McReynolds participated don't like it, they are not good sportsmen. If they object that the Supreme Court, which quite properly managed to interpret the Commerce Clause so that the federal government could protect the children of the rich from kidnapping, ought with equal propriety to be able to find power under the same clause to protect the children of the poor from child labor and sweatshops, they are not good sportsmen. If the millions of men and women who have suffered because the justice has decided that they cannot have the protection of minimum wage laws don't like it and complain about it, they are not good sportsmen. If the coal miners don't like the destruction of the Guffey Coal Act, if the railway workers don't like the destruction of their pension act, if the farmers don't like the destruction of the AAA, if the people of the Tennessee Valley don't like a constant barrage of court injunctions, then a plague on the cheeky beggars. They are one and all poor sportsmen. Abraham Lincoln once said that you couldn't indict a whole people. Lincoln and Supreme Court justices never did agree. But if the be-all and the end-all of American life is good sportsmanship, how good sportsmen are the justices of the Supreme Court? Let me read you the 16th Amendment of the Constitution. I quote, "Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration." That's the amendment. Now, this language seems to be perfectly simple and clear. The people intended to and did give to the Congress the right to assess taxes upon incomes regardless of their source. but the justices of the Supreme Court in 1920 passed judgment on their own case and solemnly amended the 16th Amendment to provide that the salaries of federal judges were not subject to a federal income tax. Mr. Justice Holmes and Mr. Justice Brandeis dissented, but Mr. Justice McReynolds and Mr. Justice Bandemander concurred. The President of the United States pays income taxes. Senators and representatives pay such taxes on their salaries, and members of the cabinet and other federal officials pay income taxes on what the government pays them. But by the Supreme Court's ukase of self-exemption, none of the justices is required to pay a federal income tax on a salary of $20,000 a year for life. The highest attribute of despotic power is that of immunity from taxation. The subject pays and the sovereign enjoys. If Louis XVI had been as humane and sportsmanlike as Mr. Justice McReynolds, he would have known how to appease hungry citizens of France when they clamored at the gates of Paris for bread. He would have told them to be good sportsmen and pay more taxes to make up for those who didn't pay. In his fireside talk, the President has given his considered political judgment that those who proposed other remedies would not be able to agree among themselves. How true that prophecy is proving. No substitute plan of any kind has been agreed upon by more than a corporal's guard. No substitute has even been proposed which would not wreck this country for months or years on end with a bitter political controversy and open no one knows what Pandora's box of new troubles. And no substitute plan has even been proposed which would give this session of Congress justification to pass or to reaffirm with reasonable hope that they would be sustained as constitutional those statutes that the people's mandate demanded last November. Such statutes and the time when we can have them, whether it shall be now or more, or 4 years from now, is what we are really fighting about. And no democracy in this stage of world history can afford to go 4 or more barren years without such laws. What have the President's opponents been able to say to you? The Chief Justice and 2 other justices, the 3 averaging the age of 78, have told you that a court of 9 judges is more efficient than a court of more than 9 judges. But at the same time, they serve notice that they would refuse to answer questions which might reveal whether a court of 9 judges efficient in torturing the Constitution might possibly be less desirable to the people of America than a court of more than 9 willing to give men, women, children and democracy a chance to live. Suppose the justices were right about efficiency, although I do not admit it, but what of it? What is more important to the American people, the pretty way the judicial wheels go round, or the effect on 130 million people of the decisions that they produce? If we must choose between judicial efficiency and economic justice under the Constitution, you and I will choose justice. What else have the President's opponents said we should be afraid of? Of anything President Roosevelt will do with the new justices? They say not. Of the appointees whom President Roosevelt will nominate in the present Senate of the United States confirm, they say not. Of anything else that may happen here and now to you and me, they say not. The only bogey they have been able to raise are formless fears of precedents, of future opportunities for possible future dictators, of future loss of civil and religious liberties. Let us look this issue squarely in the eye. I am and always have been deeply concerned about personal liberty and freedom of worship. My small law office in Chicago would experience its greatest thrill when Jane Addams would telephone us from Hull House, just over the way from this stadium, that some poor devil was in trouble. In the many cases in which I have been interested, either as a lawyer or as a citizen, I have seldom run across those corporation lawyers, those corporate caretakers, those economic embalmers of economic royalists who now cry out that if the president's proposal is accepted, our liberties and our civil rights will be swept away by a dictatorship. Now let us be realists about these liberties. No kind of legal guarantee on paper can withstand the chaos produced by the breakdown of an economic system. Courts do not function in a vacuum. The courts may momentarily protect the individual against the passion and the wrath of the community, but the courts never can and never will protect individual rights in a community which has abandoned its belief in and its devotion to the principles of personal liberty. Tolerance and a fine regard for individual rights are seldom found in communities harassed by war, domestic strife, or economic distress. Respect for law and order were not at high tide during the Depression, was not at high tide during the Depression in the farm belt when enraged farmers saw their farms foreclosed by due process of law. What availed the courage or the integrity of a few brave judges who rendered their decrees according to the mortgage bond and the letter of the law? It was not judicial heroism, but the AAA which restored the reign of law in the farm belt. Yet the AAA was declared unconstitutional by a 6-3 decision. And if our courts lose the respect and confidence of an increasingly large part of the community, their inherently slender powers will be even less able to protect individual rights. If the courts refuse because of their own economic predilections to enforce the law of the legislatures and of the people will not for an indefinite period continue to respect the decrees of the courts. I appeal to every man and woman in America who really treasures personal liberty to support the president's program for the reform of the judiciary, because it will give us courts that will allow the Congress and the legislatures of the states to cope with the pressing social and economic problems of the day. For if our democracy does not cope with these problems, while there is yet time, individual liberty will have scant chance of survival. The president's proposal, unlike the proposals of his opponents, does not take away the slightest power which the Supreme Court now has to protect the civil rights or the religious liberties of the people. And how can anyone who knows the president's record as chief executive of the United States or as governor of the state of New York think for a moment that he would appoint to the Supreme Court of the United States anyone whom he has the slightest reason to suspect is not being passionately devoted to those liberties? The words of the Constitution will not avail to protect our liberties unless the justices of the Supreme Court give force and effect to those words. Do not forget that those justices who have been the most responsible for the decisions in validating social and economic legislation are not the judges who have been the most steadfast in the protection of the civil and religious rights of the individuals. The justices who have been most solicitous to protect absolute rights of property have not been the justices zealous in the defense of human rights. Individual liberty is far more likely to be defended from new and subtle forms of encroachment by justices who are alive to the social and economic needs of the present generation than by justices who have lost touch with and who cannot understand the aspirations of their fellow men. This is therefore no time for those who love liberty and hate tyranny to betray their trust in the democratic process, to deny themselves the means of dealing with the present because of the formless spirit of the future. It is reported that the late Justice Holmes once said to Justice Stone, I quote, "My boy, about 75 years ago I learned that I was not God. And so when the people of the various states want to do something, and I can't find anything in the Constitution expressly forbidding them to do it, I say, whether I like it or not, let them do it." End quote. What we need on the Supreme Court of the United States today are fewer gods who demand fetish worship in the name of sportsmanship, and more men who are willing to help the American people do what they want to do. We want men whose mental processes remain fresh and alert and sensitive to the social changes that are going on about us, who don't think they look ahead when they gaze into a rear vision mirror. Men who realize that with individuals as with nations, from the moment that we cease to grow, we begin to die. We want men with a contemporary sense of the Constitution, who can understand, as did its framers, its capacity to adapt itself to the unforeseen and unforeseeable needs of present and future generations, who will help us make constitutional democracy function so as to avoid the alternative of either fascism or communism. Stand behind a president with vision enough to dream of such a Supreme Court. Stand behind a president with courage enough to try to give you such a Supreme Court. Don't let the odd man nullify your vote of last November. Stand behind President Roosevelt.
We pause now for station identification.
I want to present to you the Honorable Alvin W. Barkley, United States Senator from the famous state of Kentucky.
My friends, at the outset, I desire to congratulate those who are responsible for this great gathering here this evening. The very fact that you are here is a significant demonstration of the fact that democracy knows how to proceed in the United States of America. I wish also to congratulate the country upon the fact that the President's message on the judiciary has yanked this institution out of its seclusion and brought it out in the open where it belongs. The legislative and judicial developments of the past 4 years have made this inevitable. For during that period, the Supreme Court has not merely slaughtered a great part of the New Deal program. It has so narrowed the construction of the two major provisions of the Constitution as to threaten the federal government with a fatal paralysis in dealing with the problems of the nation. Such a gathering as this would have been impossible only a few years ago. It would have been impossible to bring together so cosmopolitan and intellectual an assembly to discuss what was wrong with the Supreme Court and to discuss what to do about it. Before the inauguration of the New Deal by Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Supreme Court for many years had been something about which men and women talked in sacred awe and whispered tones. And only the most courageous adventurer had the hardihood to suggest that the court was anything less than perfect. To do otherwise was to invite derision, scorn, and the abusive epithets of those who perpetually parade as professional patriots and are blind to everything about the court except its pedestal and its halo. Let me here assert what all honest and intelligent men must concede, that neither the Supreme Court or any other court is the master of the American people. All courts, whether federal or state, are agencies created by the people as tribunals for the adjustment of the disputes, for the adjudication of the rights, and for the enforcement of the privileges set out in constitutions and in statutes. They are not beyond the power of the people to change, reform, or rejuvenate. In a democracy, no public institution is above the power of public criticism. The ancient doctrine that the court is sacred and inviolate is vanishing in the light of common sense and reason. I do not mean by this that the courts as institutions are not entitled to our respect or that their decisions should not be obeyed. But I mean that the mere fact that they are called courts and have the power of decision over the rights of the people does not render them immune from public scrutiny. It emphasizes the need for such scrutiny when it, of course, touches at every vital point the social and economic welfare of a great nation of 130 million people. Until recently, those who believed that the Supreme Court should dwell apart, that it should not be moved by the impulses, or could not be moved by the impulses which actuate ordinary mortals, would have said that our present efforts are in vain, because the court was beyond the influence of current history in the determination of its decisions. But that was before the recent Washington State minimum wage case decision. Let us hope that even a majority of the Supreme Court is now becoming, as a minority had already been, aware of the new spirit of democracy in America, and is beginning to take judicial notice of its existence in the formation of its views upon social and economic legislation with which the people's representatives have sought to solve some of their great problems in recent years. If in this I am wrong, at least the Washington minimum wage case constitutes an agreeable interlude. I shall again refer to this case, but the action of the court in nullifying and overruling its benighted opinion rendered 14 years ago forms a landmark in the judicial history of the United States. And if adhered to, will result in great good to 130 million American people. Perhaps, after all, the conviction is beginning to take root in certain quarters that the poor and the humble of this America of ours have rights which are entitled to equal consideration and respect with those enjoyed by the powerful and the affluent. Why, let me ask, is it necessary to reform and revitalize the federal courts of the United States, the Supreme Court, as well as the inferior courts? The answer is simple and complete. It is because, over a period of nearly half a century, an unfortunate series of decisions have been handed down which have rendered the people powerless to control the basic elements of their social and economic life. The courts have in these decisions contended that the Constitution itself bars the way to effective control over ruthless exploitation and intolerable working conditions in commerce and in industry. I challenge that view, whether it comes from a court or whether it comes from any other source. I challenge the statement, whether it comes from litigant or court or special pleader, that the greatest chart of human liberties ever devised by mortal mind can be rightfully warped and twisted and tortured into an instrument to promote denial of a decent standard of living to millions of men, women, and children in the United States of America. Such decisions as maintain that view of the Constitution are based upon a legalistic and pedantic concept of the spirit of the instrument itself. They are not worthy of the great institutions or the traditions of liberty and the rights of man on which the nation was founded. I alone do not say that, nor does any senator alone say that, nor does the president alone say that, but some of the most eminent members of the Supreme Court itself have said that and now say that. Whatever the cause may have been, and whatever the reason may be assigned for that cause, the fact remains that because of these narrow and legalistic decisions, because the court has gone beyond its power, its proper sphere of declaring what the law is, into an improper sphere of adjudicating the folly or the wisdom of economic legislation, we are now lagging at least a quarter of a century behind our times, and behind the imperative needs in protective legislation to guard the health and the happiness of men and women and children in the United States. Our health standards are already backward. Our wage standards are in many instances shockingly low. The hourly work week in many industries is beyond the maximum of human endurance. In many respects, we're still living in an economic dark age, which has disgraced industry and manufacture ever since the transformation from the earlier days of handicraft and hand labor. Mass production has come too often to mean mass exploitation of helpless men, women, and children. In this day of the so-called Enlightenment, when billions of dollars are being expended yearly to educate the people and give them better social and economic chances in life, why are such conditions longer tolerated in this nation? Have Congress and the state legislatures failed in the performance of their duties? Are they blind and insensible to the miserable conditions which I have just described? You know the answer to that question. You know too well the long and arduous and wearisome process by which every step forward taken by labor has been challenged in the courts by highly paid special pleaders for special interests. You know the distressing tale of how often these highly paid special pleaders have succeeded in convincing the courts that simple statutes to safeguard the health of the toiling women and children of America constituted some mysterious and dangerous challenge to the Constitution of the United States of America. While you and I have been unwilling and unable to follow the devious and dubious reasoning of those who advocate this policy, we know nevertheless what havoc it has played with the attempt of Congress and the states to deal with these questions of life and death among millions of our people. It is not my purpose to attempt to detail the analysis of the vital welfare, labor legislation, which has found its graveyard in the Supreme Court of the United States. The story is too well known to need much repetition. But let us consider a few outstanding examples. In 1922, United States Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated that up to that date, the Supreme Court had invalidated a total of 300 statutes enacted by state legislatures for the benefit of working men and women. In other words, every state in the Union has been handicapped in its effort to protect the rights of the poor and underprivileged by the unfriendly attitude of the Supreme Court of the United States. What has occurred in the last 15 years since the Labor Bureau made its compilation is common knowledge. Every citizen knows how the court has struck down legislation vitally necessary to aid in lifting the country out of one depression and keep it from falling into another. The Agricultural Adjustment Act was swept away on the ground that agriculture is local and ought to be dealt with by precincts. instead of by the nation as a whole. Notwithstanding that both political parties have declared agriculture to be national in its scope and promised national efforts to deal with it. The National Recovery Act was scrapped. The Guffey Coal Act was invalidated. The First Railroad Labor Pension Act was nullified. And also the original Farm Mortgage Act. The court, or rather I should say a bare majority of the court, has set itself athwart the path of progress determined to keep this country within the narrow confines of its own antiquated economic reasoning. While the court has so repeatedly stated, it is not its function to determine the wisdom of legislation as to make the reiteration the subject of suspicion. It has gone on passing on the wisdom of legislation under the guise of constitutional interpretations. While it has for a century and a half held that a statute will be held valid unless it is unconstitutional beyond all reasonable doubt, it has ignored the rational doubt in every case created in the minds of responsible men by the sincere and able dissenting opinions of at least one less than one half of its total membership on the Supreme Court. That, my friends, is only a part of the record. I cannot here go into it further. It is a record of Congress and state legislatures rendered powerless to act for the welfare of millions of American people because a Supreme Court majority has determined that they shall not act. Is any further proof needed of the imperative necessity for the enactment of the Judicial Reform Bill proposed by Franklin D. Roosevelt, the responsible and overwhelmingly reelected President of the United States of America? Tactics of the selfish group to oppose wholesome regulation never change. They are using today the same battle maneuvers which they have used since the foundation of the Republic, and which I assume will always be used by a minority in order to nullify the will of the majority. These groups never intentionally disclose their purpose or their final objectives. They never admit that their deliberate design is to strike down statutes intended to guard helpless working men, helpless working women, and helpless working children from the callous unconcern, cold-blooded, and inhuman sweatshop operators. According to their chatter, the destruction of such a protective statute is only an unfortunate incident in the process of economic evolution. They are interested in some deep, problematical, constitutional question which is unrevealed to ordinary mortals like ourselves. They pretend that they too are interested in saving women and children in industry, but that they are more interested in saving the Constitution as it was written and ordained by the founding fathers, which makes impossible the course which they oppose. We desire to preserve the Constitution of the United States, but we do not desire to preserve it by putting it in alcohol and setting it on a shelf and allowing the people to look at it but never use it. Those who oppose this program have resorted to the old game of lifting up straw men in order to knock them down with great vigor. How familiar some of these straw men have become. We recognize these creatures of the straw pile in 1936, when the Liberty League and the other Bourbonic Tories sought to defeat Mr. Roosevelt's re-election. We recognized them in 1934, when they first became alarmed for the Constitution, when they saw the New Deal coming down the road. We have seen them paraded ever and anon when some law has been suggested or enacted for the benefit of the common man. Students of history and government tell us that even in the days of Thomas Jefferson, whose name is now invoked against the Supreme Court reform, witness straw men, which he had to demolish in order to establish free government in the beginning. From sections of the bench and bar and the social rendezvous, which are familiar to most of us, we hear the cry, "The Constitution is gone." This is one of the hoariest of the men of straw. "If we give the president this power," says another, "some dictator will arise in another day to use it for destructive purposes and for the demolishment of the people's liberties." "This is a thrust at the heart of democracy," cry still others. And still another says, "We must save the people from themselves." We recognize in these anathemas the familiar sounds which have greeted the ears of progressive and enlightened statesmanship for a century and a half. They no longer frighten us. They no longer frighten you. They no longer frighten the American Congress. And they will not frighten either branch of Congress when we vote upon this judicial reform proposal of the president. Men who founded this republic took pains to provide that the people, through their representatives in Congress, should have full and adequate authority to revise, modify, and reform the federal courts whenever such action might become necessary or advisable. That power, the existence of which is beyond question, we now propose to exercise. Before I completely acquit myself of the society of straw men, I wish to pay my respects to another familiar bogey, which has again arisen as from the tomb, but which seems to need reconsignment to its dismal grave. I refer to the dishonest and the hypocritical charge started by some of the opponents of the president's court proposal to the effect that this measure is a menace to religious or personal liberty anywhere in the United States of America. Those who have indulged in this obvious fraud are merely trying to play upon the fears of God-fearing men and women in this country. They themselves know there is no whit of truth in it. The American people are too firmly grounded in the principles of religious freedom, of the right of free press and free speech, and the right to worship God according to the dictates of their conscience, to be driven from the performance of their duty now by those who raise that bogey against this proposal. We are told also by our opponents that the Supreme Court has a fairly good record in maintaining the religious and personal rights of the people. Let us admit it. Let us admit it. The Constitution on all those subjects is so plain and explicit that not even the Supreme Court would dare misinterpret it in any decision that comes before them. But while we have enjoyed and do enjoy religious and personal liberty, while the freedom of the speech and the freedom of press have been maintained in this country, I am unwilling to bribe or attempt to bribe the Supreme Court into maintaining these great principles by surrendering our economic rights as citizens of the United States of America. It would be intolerable and unthinkable to suffer every form of social and economic maladjustment to continue in order to avoid the threat that if we seek to remedy the situation which now confronts us, we shall be punished by the loss of our personal or religious rights or liberties or privileges as we have enjoyed them for a century and a half. What then, my friends, is the heart of the controversy about which we are talking? What are we trying to do? Why are we trying to do it? Is this proposal inspired by some caprice of the human mind? Or is it inspired by a desire on the part of the responsible leadership of the forces of genuine democracy in America to make that democracy a moving, living, breathing power for the solution of the perplexing problems that face our people insofar as government may assist them? Are we satisfied? Is anybody satisfied, save those whose selfish and narrow purposes are served by it, with the recent or the present trend of judicial thinking regarding either the federal power or the powers of the states in dealing with questions whose proper settlement is vital to the life and growth of America? The need of reform, the need for more modern and liberal approach to these problems by those who wear the robes of judicial authority is now almost universally recognized by the people of the nation. It is a significant fact that almost every person who has appeared before the Committee on the Judiciary in opposition to the President's plan has produced from his bosom an alternative plan to curb the powers of the Supreme Court. It is indeed significant that the most active leaders in opposing the President's program are proposing constitutional amendments which are far more drastic in their implications and their possibilities than the relatively simple plan put forward by the President. His is the mildest of them all. The argument is now being advanced by the opponents of the court proposal that there is no need for immediate action because in the Washington minimum wage case, the court seems at last to have been converted to a more human view of the Constitution with reference to the needs and the rights of working women and children under the Constitution. It is contended now that under that decision, the court will recognize the rights of those who work as well as those who work them. The decision of the court in that case was indeed epoch-making. I welcome it with enthusiasm. I do not minimize the wholesome fact that in that decision, five justices of the Supreme Court were willing to recognize that under certain conditions, the state may legislate for the protection of those who otherwise have no protection, and by overruling a former decision, have recognized the power of Congress under certain circumstances to do the same in the District of Columbia, which is only an insignificant part of the United States of America. But can we say with any degree of certainty how far this new doctrine will be extended? Are we certain that the court has experienced a change of heart? That the rights of men, women, and children who labor in a factory and field will be accorded that consideration so vital to the maintenance of justice and equality in America? Has the court experienced a change of heart? Or has only one member of the court experienced a change of heart? The answer is emphatically no. The decision in the court of the court in the, on last Monday, of Monday of last week, was a notable victory, but it was only a skirmish in the campaign. It is too early for the victors to rest on their arms. The campaign has only begun. Let us look for a moment at the real meaning of the decision in the Washington minimum wage case. In 1923, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-3, denied the right of Congress to enact minimum wage legislation in the District of Columbia for the protection of women who work in the nation's capital. During the following, they made that decision on the ground that it was unconstitutional. During the following years, four similar statutes were invalidated by the courts, including the New York statute, which was nullified less than a year ago by a vote of 5-4. With his usual acumen, the President was the first to point out that the Supreme Court had created a no-man's land by denying the authority both of the federal and the state governments to legislate on the all-important subject of hours and wages. He pointed out that under the New York decision and the previous District of Columbia decision, and more recent decisions dealing with both state and federal power, neither the people nor their various governments could deal with the cruelties and brutalities of indifferent sweatshop operators and other exploiters of human labor. It was indeed a no-man's land, where helpless human beings could be ground into mass production while the nation and the state stood powerless either to intercede or to interfere. With the Supreme Court occupying so ridiculous and untenable a position, is it any wonder that it had a change of heart? Or should I say that one justice had a change of heart? It evidently dawned upon at least one of the justices who had formerly aided in striking down the laws for the preservation of the health and life of the people passed by both Congress and the states, that the Supreme Court had practically destroyed the power of both, and that it had well nigh destroyed the confidence of the people in that court, if it had not completely destroyed it. Under these considerations, and in the midst of the hearings and the consideration of the bill for judicial rejuvenation, which was proposed by the president, Justice Roberts shifted his position and moved over with a former minority and thus transformed it into a majority, at least for the time being. I make no complaint because of the change of view of this one justice, but I rejoice in it. I know Justice Roberts, and I owe it to him to say that I entertain for him the high personal esteem to which he is entitled as a lawyer and as a man. But the truth is that Justice Roberts, by his change of attitude since last June, amended the Constitution of the United States as completely as if Congress had submitted the amendment and it had been ratified by the required number of states. At least, he amended it by enabling the court to say, by another 5-4 decision, that what the judges said the Constitution was 14 years ago was really not what it was, but that the Constitution was then and would have been since what they now say it is, but for the mistake the court made 14 years ago in saying it was not what they now say it is. The point is not that we complain because one judge, by changing his mind, made it possible for the Supreme Court to get on the right track in saying what the Constitution is, but are we willing, for the great charter of our liberties, the fundamental framework of this republic, to be tossed back and forth like a volleyball, depending upon the mood or the personal or economic predilections of any one judge at any particular time when he participates in a decision of the Supreme Court? What greater proof do we need of the correctness of the president's position? What greater proof do we need that his opponents are deliberately beclouding the issue involved in this legislation? He has said repeatedly that there is nothing fundamentally wrong with the Constitution, but that what we need is a more enlightened interpretation of it. That we need judges who will look at that great instrument through the glasses of progressive understanding, who believe that the law grows, as Woodrow Wilson said, and is never finished. He has taken the position that if the Constitution is correctly interpreted, both Congress and the states will be adequately empowered to deal with the pressing social and economic problems that now confront them. And the decision in the Washington case, insofar as the questions there decided are concerned, overwhelmingly vindicated his judgment and his position. What an immense amount of injustice would have been avoided if in 1923 the Supreme Court had rendered an enlightened opinion in the Atkins case. What an immense amount of suffering might have been prevented if in 1923 the Supreme Court had said the Constitution meant then what they say it means now. Verily, verily, the Constitution is what the judges say it is at the moment when they say it. Education is a marvelous corrective, and let us hope that even courts are not immune from its influence. We rejoice that at least a part of no man's land is temporarily unoccupied, but it is a mistake to assume that it has been completely and permanently evacuated. What we need is the injection of fresh water into what has been a very stagnant judicial pool in the United States of America. Let us not abandon our purpose to make this fresh stream constant and permanent merely because of one partial, and it may be temporary, refreshment. The measure proposed by the President creates that constant and that permanent freshness of which I am speaking. Nearly 20 years ago, Congress enacted a law very similar to this, applying to district and circuit judges on the federal courts of the United States. It provided that when a sitting judge who has served 10 years and has reached the age of 70 fails to retire under the privileges accorded him, the President may appoint an associate judge if he finds that the sitting judge is mentally or physically incapacitated to perform his duties. Because this law almost requires the President to initiate a physical and mental examination to test the capacity of any sitting judge, it has been of no value and will continue to be of no value, even in the lower courts. The measure which is now before Congress provides that when any federal judge, whether he be on the district, circuit, or supreme bench, fails or declines to retire, when he becomes eligible for retirement, the President may appoint an associate judge or justice to assist such a retirable but unretired judge or justice. It makes automatically applicable the district and circuit judges the present law, except it relieves both them and the President of the delicacy and the embarrassment of a finding of physical or mental incapacity. In addition to this, it makes the law applicable to justices of the Supreme Court, as well as justices and judges of the district and circuit courts. Is there any reason why the Supreme Court should be exempt from this fair and wholesome process? Is there anything sacred about the Supreme Court that should lift it above all human consideration? The Supreme Court is composed of men who are not greatly different from other mortals. They are subject to the influence of early training, of environment, of professional association, and the intellectual slants that actuate other men. Some of them are even victims of their own prejudices and animosities which they have accumulated over the years. The Supreme Court, on the whole, determines exclusively vital questions of constitutional construction involving not only property, but human welfare as well. Shall we be content to reform and revitalize the inferior courts and leave the Supreme Court untouched by this renewing process? What we propose is constitutional. What we propose does not destroy or touch the power of the Supreme Court. What we propose does not force any judge to retire from any court, but it offers an opportunity to place on the Supreme Bench men whose minds are at least open and fair, and whose intellectual processes are not closed in advance to any favorable consideration of any new legislation that comes out of the American Congress for the relief and the benefit of the American people. What we propose offers an opportunity to place on the highest court in this land men who are not wedded to a tortured construction of constitutional power on the part of state and nation to deal with modern life in the light and the spirit of our forefathers, who wrote an instrument intended to be sufficiently adaptable and flexible not to require amendment with every changing phase of American life. What we propose offers an opportunity for the American people to have their registered will acknowledged and respected under the broad powers contained in the Constitution by the Supreme Court of this land. This measure proposed by the President, now pending in the Great Committee on the Judiciary of the United States Senate, and soon I trust to be brought upon the floor of the Senate itself, is more than a court reform program. Under the wise leadership of President Franklin D. Roosevelt and with the determined support and approval of the American people, it will become a new economic bill of rights to the men, women, and children who are the real producers of all the wealth that we enjoy in this great nation of ours. And I am glad to say to those who are assembled here that we have the votes to put it over in the Senate and House of Representatives.
You have been listening to Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior, and Alvin W. Barkley, United States Senator from Kentucky, who discussed the plan for reorganization of the higher judiciaries of this nonpartisan citizens' mass meeting in the Chicago Stadium in Chicago, Illinois. This meeting was sponsored by the Chicago Committee for the President's Court Plan. The co-chairmen for tonight's meetings were Charles B. Schwartz, Chicago attorney, and William F. Clark, Dean of the DePaul University Law School. Professor Charles E. Merriam of the University of Chicago was the honorary chairman. This program came to you from our Chicago location. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.